Well, in this segment of the IRW project to record some of the history of radio and electronics in the early days in South Australia, I'm speaking today to Mr. Jack Strawn. Welcome, Jack. Maybe you could start by giving us an idea how you became interested or got into the business of, I think yours was radio communications mainly, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, that goes back a few years now, I say, back to my first introduction to radio. I should say it was about 1934, 1935, I should say. It was just at the end of the Depression, and I can distinctly remember a person, how I was first introduced to it, and it was at we lived in the town of Goolwa, and it was a person by the name of Dunstall. He was he had a travelling picture show from originated from Yankalilla, and he used to travel through to Port Elliot and Goolwa, Victor Harbour, and those places with their weekly shows. And immediately the Depression broke, I think one of the biggest jobs that came out from the government was the building of the barrages at Goolwa. And it was then that we got the first touch of what they termed very modern radio in those days, and that was the introduction of the Super Heterodyne set. And I can distinctly remember one being produced, the major producer I think in Australia at that particular time was AWA, and there was a big manufacturer in Adelaide here by the name of Harrington's, and they produced their first Super Heterodyne by the name of Imperia. It didn't take on the as well as it was considered, in opposition to the more well-known radio manufacturers, the larger ones, and it finished up getting the name for a long time as Inferior. It just didn't want to work. But however, to cut a long story short, this Frank Dunstall had the franchise on these particular sets to sell, and he sold them, quite a number of them in the Goolwa area, to the people that had just come out of the Depression and started working in the barrage, on the barrage. With the result that he traded in on these particular Super Heterodyne receivers. He traded in everything that you think of. Anything, if they had a wheelbarrow or a set of tools or whatever, you name it, he'd take it in, as well as any of the very early type prior to the Super Heterodyne receivers, the old second-hand radios. And that was the first introduction I got to it, because Frank said to me, look at all this junk around here. He said, how would you like to have that? And I reckon that was really good, to have this handed over to you on a plate. You know, prior
all
to
these trade-in
radios. Mm. And I took these and I pulled them all to pieces, and I made big enough study of as I could. And I remember I transformed these sets into what I reckon were respectable types of radios. And I used to take these to pieces, go down to the plumber, get some galvanised iron, make up a chassis, it was rough as bags, transfer these parts onto it, and then resurrect these into a more modern type receiver. Mm. Now, that was the first introduction. That's water under the bridge now. This went on for quite a time, and in 1937, I remember, I shifted to Murray Bridge, where I then went into got into working with a local dealer up there. He's still going, as a matter of fact. Well, he's an elderly person now, well retired, but that was Alan Smythe.
Oh, yes.
And you remember Alan Smythe?
The name, yes.
Yes.
Did you sell these sets that you made up?
No, I when I say did I sell them, we used to do a lot of funny things down there to supplement our meagre pittance from the work. I was employed at that particular time in the Goulwell Powerhouse. Mm. That was a privately run show by the name chap by the name of J.H. Croker. And he employed me at a meagre pittance of 7 and 6 a week, of which not only did you have to, supposed to run the power station, but you had to read the meters, the local meters of the town. Yeah. And that was coordinated with the radio side, so it was electrical and radio. When I shifted from there in 1937 to Murray Bridge, I suppose I thought I had enough experience to branch out in a little higher field, you see, so I went in with Alan Smythe, and probably some people would probably know the late Bob Grundy too. Remember Bob Grundy?
Yeah, I've heard the name.
He was a great radio chap. He was engineer in charge of 5PI, and he recently passed away last year. And he and I and Alan worked together there, and from there we got a fair bit of, service experience on radios, and was beginning more modern after the introduction from the 1936 vintage. And from there I joined the Commonwealth Railways, and that's where my major experience came in, and that was in October 1941. October 1941, I went to Port Augusta. That was the headquarters of the railway, or the secretariat was in Melbourne, but the main workshop area was in Port Augusta. And I remember you can just hold that a second. Yes, and I can remember the introduction I got to the Port Augusta workshops, because it appeared that there was very, very little knowledge of radio in the town, and none at all in the railways, because it was a big industry, and they catered all for the electrical and coach building and maintenance of locomotives and such things, but nothing in the field of radio. So after I got to be known there, and they realised that I had a bit of an inkling for radio. Many people used to come, to say, can you do something to this? Can you improve this radio? Can you make this better, or something like that? And prior to leaving Adelaide, or leaving Murray Bridge, I was contacted by a gentleman by the name of Bill Jeffries. Unfortunately, Bill is no longer with us. And he was in charge of the radio at Newton McLaren's. They were then in Lee Street. And Bill came to me and asked me, would I be prepared to do a spot of service work or maintenance on the domestic radios for a chappie in Port Augusta who he announced to me as being the distributor for the AWA Radiola, and his name happened to be Otto Richmuller. Now, this was in 1941, just the beginning of the war, and I said yes, I'd certainly look after him what I could, do what I could for him, and the result was that I used to go down in the evenings to Otto's and maintain the radios that he'd been brought into his shop for repairs, and get them going, and he'd he'd send them on their way next day because he covered a very, very big area. He covered right out on the east-west line. He used to send them right out as far as Cook, Tarcoola, Barton, and places such as that. And these are the maintenance depots out along the east-west line. And he had a very, very good, very, very good clientele, and he was a very, very nice type of person too. With it, he'd do anything for his customers, and he was very well known in Port Augusta. Now, I had taken to Port Augusta with me the only asset that I'd ever owned, and that was a public address system that, prior to leaving Murray Bridge, we used to cater for the horticultural shows at Caroondra, Strathalbyn, Callington, and much like towns as that, and do all the PA work with this mobile equipment. And I took this with me to Port Augusta, and it was quite a large piece of equipment. It was an amplifier capable of, I'd say, about 100 watts of audio. It included a pair for the benefit of anybody with the knowledge of the radio parts, made back in those days, with a pair of 807s, which were introduced, I think, just to the beginning of the war. I think they were
just before
the war. This particular valve was introduced, and it provided quite a lot of noise anyway. And with this, I had 5 12-inch loudspeakers mounted on a big panel. Well, Otto agreed that we store this in his back room. And seeing that I had no immediate use for it there. Well, the time came just in 1941, the end of 1941 when I got there, 1942, that the town was looking for an air raid system, air raid warning system. And it was suggested by the powers to be that they would be installing into the town a series of wailing sirens mounted on strategic points around the town. I remember one on the town hall, one towards the hospital, one on the west side. And they were to be powered by the 240 volt supply that in that particular time was serviced by the Commonwealth Railways. This was prior to the Electricity Trust being introduced into that particular area, or having even taken over that particular area. And these sirens were to be activated by a series of telephone circuits through the PMG's repeater station or exchange, and at the appropriate time they were set off in a central position, and that was the idea that was going to be introduced. I considered a better idea to have something that was free of any danger of being interfered with as far as telephone circuits. And I made a suggestion to the department, that was the railways department, that we install an air raid siren on the top of their power station, which was in the precincts of the workshop area. And instead of relying upon the power to power this the amplifier, I suggested that we manufacture this from the loudspeakers and the 100 watt amplifier that I owned at that time, and mount this on the roof of the high building, and included at the top was 3 exponential horns, of which were made in the workshops out of 3 ply sheeting. They were about 6 foot long, and they had quite a big end opening in them. They were quite penetrating. And we used this amplifier in conjunction with a wailing system, or a the siren noise was made out of a, we processed that out of a gramophone motor with an extended shaft onto which we turned, we fitted several discs with a varying number of teeth cut out, and they were superimposed onto pickup coils out of the headphones of telephone sets.
That's improvisation, isn't it?
And we, with the varying teeth measurements on the number of teeth on these discs being driven at a constant speed from the gramophone motor, it created a sensational wailing noise, and this was virtually similar in any respect to the then Hammond organ. The Hammond organ was introduced from America, and they used the tone generator in their Hammond organ. It was a similar thing. And however, this fitted the bill very nicely, and we, instead of using the power generated in the main station in case the engines were put out of action, we provided the power from a petrol engine, a small stationary petrol engine, and I had at that time with me an alternator that I had made prior to coming to Port Augusta, and we used this in the remote areas at Murray Bridge, where power wasn't available on ovals, and I had this alternator I made out of a northeast generator. We fitted a pair of slip rings to this alternator, put a permanent field, DC field from the 12 volt battery of the car, and drove this, being a four pole machine, we drove this from the fan belt off the engine of a Maxwell car that we had at that time. And we, at 1,500 revs, we produced 240 volts at 50 cycles. Yeah. Now, that was very, very useful for places which weren't, in those days, didn't have the domestic power available. Well, I had this thing with me at Port Augusta amongst my amplifier equipment. So we introduced this and coupled it to a petrol engine, drove this independently to the service provided by the powerhouse, set the amplifier up, and we set this thing going. Well, did it make a noise? It really fitted the bill nicely. It went all over the town, over to the west side, which was about a 2 mile radius of the power station, and we did get reports, as a matter of fact, in those days, that the people out at Stirling North, which was 5 mile distance, could hear this wailing noise. And we thought we're all set up to go. That was a very, very fine piece of fine exercise, proved that it was going to work. Well, within 48 hours of this happening, there was an invasion into Port Augusta by the army. First of all, now just prior to that, the night after this happened, or the day of the night after this happened, at about 4:30 in the evening when the workshops closed down, I was walking home and I was intercepted by the local police. There was the sergeant, detective, and a couple of others, and they interrogated me just outside the workshop gate and asked me would I like to escort them to the police station for a talking. Mm-hmm. Well, I followed their request and we went down there, and I couldn't make out what was going on. I thought, now that's funny. Something's very, very odd here. And of course, I'd only been in Port Augusta a matter of 2 or 3 months when this happened. And after after we'd discussed the matter at the police station, the following day we were intercepted there by the army from Adelaide. They'd sent up two or three of their top brass, I suppose you might say, yeah. In the form of captains or colonels or whatever they were. And they got to work on me and they questioned me and they put the third degree onto me and they said, Strawn, how do you spell that? And I said, Strachan. They said, that's a very good German name, isn't it? And I said, no, I don't think so. I've always thought that was Scotch. Well, they said, do you know a person by the name of Rich Muller? I said, yes, I do. I said, he's a local radio man in the town here. Otto Rich Muller? I said, yes. I said, as a matter of fact, I see him quite often. I service his equipment. Well, then the penny dropped, and I thought, well, gee whiz, the war's on. I've done something wrong here. So I started to ask the question of what was it all about. And they said, well, it's about this amplifier. This amplifier that you're using for an air raid warning. Do you know that is capable of transmitting signals all across the world? And I said, yes, I said, it possibly could if it created a lot of interference from an irregularity built into the equipment, or what shall we say?
You were looking for parasitics. Parasitics. They wouldn't have known what that meant.
Built into the equipment, such as, you know, parasitic oscillation, that's the word, that's what I was thinking of. Yes. And I do realise that the 807 valve was capable of producing this, but however, we thought, well, you know, we'd have that suitably suppressed because there's methods of suppressing it, and we went into the technicalities of that, so I accepted that. And the word was said, told to me, no, you, under no circumstances will this thing be permitted, because we have got all the equipment set, lined up, to be installed in Port Augusta. Oh, yes, so I left that with them, and the very next week, up came all the sirens. And the sirens were established in Port Augusta, the three wailing sirens, one on the town hall, one on the west side, and one on the corner of Hospital Road, and that was suffice to provide sufficient warning in the town itself. But then the thing came up, well, another question I asked, well, what if the, and they were going to be serviced by a series of telephone lines through the local post office exchange, and actuated from a central point in an office in the Commonwealth Railways. What if the telephone line fell down? What would happen then? It wouldn't go off, but that wasn't accepted. That just couldn't happen. So anyway, we lost the deal on the amplifiers, and we packed it up, put it away down in Otto Richmuller's shop again in safe custody, and I lived happily ever after up there for 36 years.
And was Otto still allowed to carry on his business?
Yes, Otto carried on his business. Everything was fair and square, above board. Yes, he was an honest citizen. He was. He was quite a type. And that was in 1941. Now, immediately following that, I still persisted in trying to introduce radio into the Commonwealth Railways. And this was, I thought, was a good idea as far as the passenger trains were concerned. They were still running passenger trains through to the west. The Transcontinental Express was running. It was non-air conditioned in those days, of course, and they had long journeys. And I gave consideration to or put a proposition that why didn't we put a bit of time in trying to introduce something better than the method that they used for producing the news reports for the passengers on the train. What used to happen was that the train used to leave Port Augusta, come from Adelaide, leave Port Augusta, and they used to post a bulletin in the lounge car of the passenger train at Port Augusta, typed out in the Port Augusta railway station, and that was taken from the ABC News at probably lunchtime. And then the train used to progress to Tarcoola, which is about 256 miles northwest of Port Augusta. And they used to type another sheet out at Tarcoola and pin into the lounge car. And then it would proceed to Cook, which was another 250 miles. And they used to do the same thing there, and then on to Rawlinna, do the same thing there, and then finish up into Kalgoorlie, where they had their local broadcast stations. Now, that was the way they used to entertain the passengers or give the passengers the up-to-date news. And it was thought then that radio should have improved a little in some respect. So we tried this, but until the end of the war, until 1946, there was no show, no hope of ever introducing it because of the thought behind it that these radios could produce interference and broadcast unwanted information across the airwaves. And when you look back to those days, it was quite logical, I should say, because you know, you could talk to people then and talk to people for many years after that. And I can remember this because I was involved in communications in the railways for all the period that I was in Port Augusta. And I can remember distinctly that people, that were in prominent positions, like traffic managers, assistant traffic managers and types of people like that used to run the business, they could never conceive how you could ever get a signal without a pair of wires and a telephone handset between your ears.
Yeah.
It was a fact.
Yes.
And this sort of put the kibosh on it, and so we sort of concentrated, what will we do? We knew we had no hope until 1946, so the war finished in 1946, and then the game was set. I was still convinced that it would be the answer. And it went on for a long time, and there was one particular person who I've got to give credit to from then until this day, and that is the late Patrick Hanbury. He was then the chief civil engineer in Port Augusta, and he elevated to the position of commissioner for the railways. And he was quite firm and quite definite that this should be done. Something should be done in the electronic field. And he was the only one. And of course, there was a dissension between parties then, and I suppose it goes on now, because P.J. Hanbury was the chief civil engineer. He had no authority over the chief mechanical engineer, who was my immediate boss, and therefore they didn't really agree. They agreed to disagree.
Professional jealousy.
And the result was that you could never get the complete consensus of opinion that something had to be done. It was the right thing. So we juggled this for a long, long time, and we built radios and we used them in the workshops, but they never ever got introduced onto the train. Never ever. Nothing got introduced onto the train, with the exception of, back in those days, we introduced a wire recorder, and that was a piece of equipment prior to the magnetic tape recorders. You'd remember those.
Those units were made by AWA in
Melbourne. AWA by Pyrox.
Yes, right. I was involved with AWA in Melbourne making those
things. I've got one home now.
Have you?
Yes, I've got one.
Gosh, I remember that job quite well. I was only a lad, but...
Yeah,
that's interesting, isn't it? I was wondering if that was going to come out, because I thought, I remember working on that job. It was a big deal for us in those days to have this Commonwealth Railways job.
Yes. Well, Bill Jeffries, had known him since 1936, or prior to, finally 36 years, Bill was, Newton McLaren's were the agents for AWA in Adelaide, and... I mentioned this to Bill, and Bill was the one that started the ball rolling with these tape recorders, and we talked to P.J. Hannabury, who was still chief civil engineer, but he had a bit of weight behind him, and he pushed his message to Melbourne, and Melbourne, oh, good, yes, that'll be good. Yes, we'll have that. So my job in the electrical side of the business was to introduce a method of driving these units, which we didn't produce ourselves. They were produced, I think they were produced by AWA, as a matter of fact. I'm not absolutely sure of this because the converters I never saw any more of, but we used DC to AC converters.
They were made in Melbourne.
And these were driven from... the batteries from the lounge cars. Now these lounge cars, the electrical equipment on these lounge cars were quite huge. They were manufactured by J. Stone and Company in England, and they were tail shaft driven. They were driven with a spline shaft off a differential arrangement off the axles of the car. And these were understrung under the car bodies, and they produced something like 48 volts at 48 volts at about 60 amps, which was quite a large amount of current from an underslung generator to charge these big two sets of batteries. And they had a system which was known as a pegoid system. Means very little to people, except that it was a mechanical device, an electromechanical device, that every time the train stopped, at any time it did stop, whether it ran 200 miles or 20 miles, this pegoid would change over and charge up a stationary set of batteries, a battery that wasn't being exhausted. And that meant we had a battery in a static condition that was drawn from with a measurement of a static 48 volts, which didn't vary because it was found back there where the generator with not a very good regulator on it was capable of generating anything from 48 volts up to 60 volts. And this used to vary the battery voltage considerably and put this wire recorder right out of kilter because the voltage used to vary from the frequency used to vary from 50 cycles to 60 and down to 40 and all over the place. So we had to make it as constant as we could. So to make it constant, we decided that the battery should be constant voltage, hoping that it didn't run long enough that it would deteriorate to a stage where the thing wouldn't operate. So you'd have to watch that aspect of it. In other words, if it ran 50 miles, we'd have 50 miles of good voltage, and if we ran 200 miles, we might have 100 miles of good voltage, 100 miles of poor voltage. Yes. So those things were considered. So these wire recorders, they were the in thing. And They took off very, very well, but there was only one thing that went wrong with it, was the fact that the dining car staff that consisted of waiters, chefs, conductors of the train, they were delegated the job of handling this piece of equipment. And of course that was another thing. They reckoned that was far beyond their knowledge. That was an electrical job. That wasn't a mechanical piece of work, not like a gramophone or anything. And it should have been in the hands of a technician that would have had to been fully employed on the train. Well, you can imagine, you know, doing anything like, you couldn't employ one man to do this.
To look after the gear.
So they finally decided, well, they relented and they decided they would do it. Well, if anybody has ever used one of these wire recorders and known how cantankerous they can become, you'll agree with me that it looked to me that it was going to have a fairly short life.
Yes.
And that would have been in about 1949, 1950, I should say. And believe you me, it didn't have a very long life, because with the rough track that existed and the rough riding, because of the early make of cars and that, with the rock and roll that used to go on these things, the poor old conductor, when he used to go to thread one of these machines up, it'd take a lurch to the right and a lurch to the left, and the wire would go all over the place, and the next thing, the wire would have been, oh, I would say 2 or 3 thou in diameter.
It was very thin.
Very thin. Thin, just larger than the hair on your head. And it would consist of a reel of this wire. They were only about 3 inches in diameter by about 3/4 inch thick, and they'd run for about an hour's play. And this wire would run through a recording head or a replay head and record magnetically, similar to what present-day tape recorders record on a magnetic tape. On a magnetic strip, which is now 1/4 inch wide. Well, the conductors used to be that frustrated with this thing that they'd put this reel on, go to thread it up, the car'd give a lurch, that'd be the end of the wire, so they'd just open the window of the lounge car and pitch it out onto the Nullarbor Plain. If anybody could go out there now, I'll guarantee they'd find dozens of these. Because it was stainless steel wire.
Yes, that's right.
And if you ever could come across them. And this very well set the old wire recorder back in its tracks, and it didn't do too good at all. By the time the train had come back to Port Augusta, they'd say, where are the programs? And they'd say, well, you'll have to go back to, you know, Barton and have a look, or out at Aldi, somewhere along the Nullarbor, and have a look for them, because that's what they did. Now, that finished the wire recorder episode. Now, in 1952, P.J. Hanbury was then Commissioner of the Railways. Prior to that, he was appointed Commissioner of the Railways after the retirement of the previous Commissioner, George Garn. And P.J. Hanbury was still set on this radio on the trains. And he had it set in his mind from as far back as I can remember, in 1941 to 1952, when he went to Germany and he purchased 2 passenger trains. That was prior to 1952, probably 1951. And he went to Germany, arranged for the contracts of these 2 trains from the Wegmann Engineering Company in Germany. And they were to be equipped in Germany with a PA system comprising of 2 100-watt amplifiers in each lounge car, and and a distribution system through all the trains of a 5-inch speaker in each compartment. There was two consists comprising, I might be wrong here, and I would say in all, say 24 passenger cars, 12 on each. I might be wrong, but in round figures there was a dining car, a lounge car, and 10 or 12 or 10 passenger cars. And every class, first class and second class, were equipped with these loudspeakers in each compartment, each sleeping compartment. And the lounge car was elaborately set up with a multiple collection of speakers. And the amplifiers were supplied, and that was the end of it. There was nothing that the rest of it had to be introduced at Port Augusta. There was no radio, there was no turntables, there was no wire recorders, no tape recorders or anything. So when the trains arrived in Port Augusta in November 1952, on the 7th of November 1952 was the inaugural run of the first passenger train to Kalgoorlie and back, and it comprised all the VIPs that you could nominate. There was no paid passengers. So we drifted across to Kalgoorlie and back. And a week or two before this, P.J. Hannabury was the commissioner, came to me and said, "Look, Jack, we've got to do something about this radio. What do you think you can do for the inaugural run?" I said, "Well, we'll have a look around." And I had in my possession an HRO receiver. It's an American Air Force receiver that was surplus to was Army surplus following the 1946, and I had one of these in my possession as my receiver in my amateur station, matter of fact. And I said, "Well, we could utilise this for a test run across to Kalgoorlie and back, and then from that we could assess what was necessary, and then let's go into seeing what we can do in manufacturing something." And he thought that was a pretty good idea. And I said, "Now, there was another thing that we wanted to introduce, and that was radio on trains from front to back." And I was concerned with this. I was interested in this back in those days in 52. And we searched around, and I found out that the Pye Company in Melbourne had bought out from England a series of Cambridge VHF receivers, transceivers. They were valve-operated, the 1.4-volt valve-operated things with very minimum amount of output. And being the secretary, being in Melbourne, I spoke to the commissioner to find out whether they could get in touch with Pye to see whether we could hire, borrow or steal a couple of these units. So he did that, and we got hold of a pair of Cambridge receivers on an unlicensed frequency, incidentally. Nobody knew about it except ourselves. Yeah. And we put this, one on the locomotive and one on the brake fan. But unfortunately, it didn't work. It didn't work to any satisfaction at all. It was something very unusual. Well, I suppose it was a minimal amount of power. It had to be powered by a separate battery, which was, had to last several days, yeah. Things like that. And the whole thing went irregular. It was a try, but it didn't work. But the test run that we did to Kalgoorlie with this HRO receiver was quite promising. And we took measurements because it had a signal strength meter on it, so we could measure the signal strength out to Tarcoola and beyond. Then we had short wave where we where we lost the broadcast stations, we took 5CK, as a matter of fact, and 5CK provided our signal until we got to Tarcoola. From Tarcoola on, it was early hours of the morning, and everybody went to sleep. And when we went in the morning, we were in the middle of the Nullarbor Plain, and then we set up shortwave stations from Radio Australia and various frequencies until we got over to Xanthus, which was the Coonanna and Xanthus with the two outstations from Kalgoorlie. And from there on, from Xanthus through to Coonanna and then into Parkeston, which was the terminus, the Commonwealth terminus at Kalgoorlie, we picked up 6GF, which was the ABC station there. So this was all written down and documented and tests taken and came back and submitted to Melbourne, and Melbourne agreed that we should carry on with the job. Well, that's time went by. We manufactured 3 receivers in the workshops, and the coil units on these receivers was a 4-band coil unit made by Kingsley Love. He had a manufacturing concern in Melbourne, and he'd made a lot of equipment for the Army. He copied the HRO, as a matter of fact, and was the AR7.
Yes, aware of his operations. Yes.
And I went over and discussed this with Kingsley Love, and yes, he'll manufacture these. They were a one-off thing. So he manufactured 4 of these kits. We built 3 and had 1 for a spare. And they were three shortwave bands covering the whole of the Radio Australia spectrum in those days, and a broadcast band. I came down to Adelaide and I met a chap that had a business at Parkside, and he was I consulted with a gentleman in Adelaide. He was a graphic artist, to produce an appropriate dial for these receivers, and we used an EFCO dial. Was another manufacturer of the broadcast or the dials for broadcast receivers in Australia. The EFCO people in Sydney, I believe they were, or maybe Melbourne, they produced this. We removed their front glass from that, and we had this gentleman design a very artistic design of the coat of arms of Australia with Commonwealth Railways, in the colours of the train, which was maroon and gold, and we superimposed on this the prominent stations, so that untrained or unskilled personnel could tune the receiver and say, well, 5CK should be there,
yes,
and 5GF, 6GF should be there, etc., etc. Well, that simplified matters, and it looked quite elaborate. As a matter of fact, the first one I ever made of these receivers, when I think back now, you know, what used to happen, it was a receiver in a 19-inch rack. It was 19 inches wide by about 12 and a half inches high, with the dial, signal strength meter on it, just similar to the HRO. As a matter of fact, I copied the S meter circuit from the HRO, and I produced this set and the panels of it. I can remember now that they were brown crackle finish, and they were done in the domestic oven or stove home in our kitchen, in the wife's kitchen. Used to take this home, paint it, put it in the oven, bake it, take it out and have a look. If it wasn't good enough, redo it. So we perfected that was the first receiver ever made. And that receiver is now in the museum, in the PM, in the telecom museum in Adelaide.
Is that?
Yes, that was. They took that over, and it now rests there in the museum in the post office building. So this receiver was introduced into the lounge car with these 100 watt amplifiers, and the trains didn't go into public service for two or three months because they had to be serviced and various things done to them and all the rest of it. So it gave us enough time to do this, and we then put into this train the only thing that we could think of as far as playing music was a turntable playing 33 and a third records into a cabinet with this receiver, and that was introduced in about the November, December, January, about the February of 1953, and that gave the program to the train to allow the passengers to listen to news broadcasts and entertainment where it was capable of being received, and as well as that to play records, which was partly successful but not extremely successful. The fact that the power supplies on these trains were very, very elaborate. They were commercially graded 415, 240 volt, 50 cycle AC, which provided all the power for the respective air-conditioned motors underneath each car, the lighting and everything that goes with it. And they consisted of three plants. There were two in the power car at the end of each train, consisting of two 250-watt alternators, giving a total capacity of 500 kilowatts. And
how did those turntables go with the vibration on the train?
That was the main problem. Speed-wise, they were synchronised. The 50 cycle was quite stabilised, but it was a problem with the vibration. That was the main thing, and it still was a rough track back in those days, because it wasn't until well after 1955, 1960 that the transcontinental line was re-sleepered and then built up with a welded track, which it is today. It's a very fine track today, but it wasn't until after 1960 that took place. So up until that time, they had to put up with this irregularity in the condition of the operating of the trains, and it was pretty rough, and that used to put the turntable off balance quite a lot and throw the old stylus over. Matter of fact, when you consider that the stylus pressures on those discs were supposed to have been about anything below 5 grams or 2.5 grams or 1.5 grams, we used to put weights of ounces on them to keep them on the disc. They almost used to transcribe the information on the other side. So anyway, it entertained the passengers, and it wasn't long before the turntables went out, and then we introduced the Beyer company in Melbourne, produced a tape recorder, the Beyer 66, and we purchased a series of those. They were taken over later by the Roller company, and the Roller company then sold out, I don't know who to, but I still think they're still producing them for the ABC today, are they?
I think it's Commonwealth Electronics now.
That's right.
Yes, Commonwealth Electronics that still produce it. I have one home, as a matter of fact, the 66, which was quite, you'd remember those,
yes,
of course.
Yes.
Very nice piece of equipment. Well, we put bio recorders into the lounge cars, and they serviced the public until right up until the building of the Port Augusta or the Stirling North to Lee Creek line, which would have been in 1970. I might be a little bit out here, 1970s. And that was a standard gauge line from Port Augusta to Lee Creek and then to Maree. And then from Maree to Alice Springs was narrow gauge, 3'6". And the Wegman cars, which were commonly known as the red cars, they were the maroon cars, they were transferred to the North Line to service Port Augusta to Maree, and then Maree to Alice Springs. They had a series of the coaches that were transferred onto 3'6" bogies. And there was one thing peculiar to the lounge cars and the dining car of the Wegman series, and that was that when they were purchased, it was known that they were to be 6 inches wider than the standard gauge practice. And it was a cunning move, we thought, on behalf of the Commonwealth Railways, that these cars would never ever go off their territory because they wouldn't fit in the station platforms of the state railways or the New South Wales. So with the wider cars, they remained on the Commonwealth Railways line forever and a day. They're still there, presumably, whether they're in cold storage or whatever, they were still running when the narrow gauge track was closed down with the introduction of the new Tarcoola to Alice Springs standard gauge track, which was I retired in 1974, having completed the job of the communication system from the Tarcoola to Alice Springs, which we introduced a microwave system there in place of the pole and open wire route which existed on the Trans-Australian line. And that's the that was the finish of the radio on trains as far as the original setup was concerned. They were transferred to the Maree Alice Springs line, of which they serviced that line until it was closed down and would have been in 1975. And the new trains that ran on the Tarcoola to or Port Augusta to Alice Springs line were manufactured under licence. They were manufactured by the Comm Engineering Company in Sydney. And prior to that, there were two trains purchased in Japan that took over the running of the transcontinental train when they transferred those to the narrow gauge. And the transcontinental train were the two Japanese trains that were superseded by the trains manufactured under licence here by in the Commenge from the Budd Company in America. So they are still now known and running with the equipment that we introduced onto them, and they were the whole of the equipment that was introduced onto the Indian Pacific and the Transcontinental train, which runs to this day, were manufactured by ourselves originally, that's Commonwealth Railways, and then they were let by contract to outside manufacturers, and they consisted of similar equipment, 100 watt audio amplifiers, speakers in all cabins, and radio, tape recording. And I do believe now, since I retired, they've introduced closed circuit TV.
Yes, I think there are. You mentioned there one stage about having this HRO receiver for amateur radio.
Yes.
How long have you been involved with amateur radio?
Well, I've been. I got my license in my amateur license in 1942. I got my broadcast license in 1942, and I got my amateur license in 1946.
There would have been there were no amateur licenses during the war anyway, were there?
So no. No amateur licenses during the war. Mm. No.
And did you do the study for things like your broadcast course? Where did you do
courses? I did a course through the Marconi School.
Oh, yes, the correspondence
course. Yes. Yeah. Mm. Yes, through the Marconi Correspondence School. And I slipped up on that. 1942 was 1940. I'd have to be could be corrected on that. The certificates are home anyway. Yeah. I know the
what
broadcast
sort of training had you done before that? Like you started off down at Goulwood just reading and fiddling around. Had you done any courses before you did the
Yes, I did. I did a course. Through the what was it called? The ARC?
The Australian Radio College. Yeah. That's right. The correspondence
course. Correspondence course. Yeah. Through them, and I supplemented that when I first started off on the electrical side.
Yes.
With in the power station at Goor, and then I sort of put that aside to radio, and radio has been my main field, if you understand, and it wasn't until this new passenger train business was introduced into Commonwealth Railways that the signals and telephone and everything was segregated, because in railway working right throughout Australia, it's always been known as the signals and telegraph section, the S&T section. They still have it here in South Australia. Commonwealth Railways segregated that, and they called it the electrical section and signals and the communication section. And then I took over and was appointed communications engineer from then on until I retired.
Right. And how did you get on with these correspondence courses? Were you up at Port Augusta in those times when you were doing that?
I was both in Murray Bridge and Port Augusta. Yeah. I continued there.
Yeah.
I did it continuously for quite a long period.
Yeah. Long haul, isn't it?
It's a long haul.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. A long haul. Yeah.
Indeed.
I've still got most of those, most of the technical one of the books home there, you know, in the library. Of course, you keep those things.
Yes.
And other encyclopedias that you pick up along the way. And, we've just shifted, as you know. After I got this sickness, I had to sell out. We've gone into a unit.
Oh, yes.
And now most of the books are parked away because you haven't got enough room to park.
That's right. Yeah, you wonder what will eventually happen, don't you?
Yeah.
Jack, I was wondering if you'd like to mention something about the IRWE. I can remember meeting you on the train going over to some of the conventions.
Over to Melbourne?
Yes.
Yes,
and
also that's right.
The annual dinners?
Yes, that's... Yeah, I've almost forgotten about that. Yeah, all right, we start again. I was in... Yes, I go back to 19... Go back to 1938... when Bill Guffenlock from Newton McLaren's, he introduced me in the first instance to the IRE, and I joined the IRE, I think I got my first certificate in 1945, I think it is. And I went through there, and I used to, yes, we followed this very religiously from that day right through until very late years, when we used to, I always looked forward to it and convinced the railways, as a matter of fact, the powers to be, that I should, be allowed to attend these conventions. Yeah. Yeah, the Melbourne conventions and the dinners down here at the CDA, Commercial Travellers.
Radio Founders Day dinners.
Yeah, Radio Founders Day. I came down to those every year. I don't think I missed any years there. And I went through to Melbourne throughout all those years, and the railways accepted that, the powers to be accepted it, that it would be a good idea to keep up with the present day standards. So that was appreciated, yes. That started off back in 1939, I should say, when I first met Bill Governlock.